With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In place of democracy, very good.
G'day and welcome to Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. Now, if you rank the issues of major importance to Australia and the world in the 21st century, it'd be pretty hard to go past the pandemic. That's understandable because this is a genuine global emergency with now over 4 million lives lost. And of course, in Australia at present, we're seeing the emergence of another wave. A long-predicted winter return of the virus, but this time in more virulent Delta form. This has exposed the Morrison government's rather cavalier approach through the middle of 2020 as it received praise for successful suppression of the virus, overwhelmingly the achievement of the states, by the way. This week's revelations that Kevin Rudd made overtures to the global head of Pfizer are another embarrassment for the government, which insists Rudd's efforts had no impact on the company's decision to accelerate the delivery of Pfizer from later this month. Health Minister Greg Hunt says it was the government's own overtures that secured the step up, which, whether true or not, amounts to an admission that the original timetable agreed on was too slow. Who knew? Apart from everyone, that is. Anyway, there are two other issues beyond the pandemic, and of course we hope the pandemic will be managed before too long, and they are climate change and the rise of China. Unfortunately, neither of these is likely to go away anytime soon, and it's to the latter that we direct our attention today. Hugh White is Emeritus Professor of Strategic Studies at the Australian National University, as well as being a former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Defence, and he wrote the Defence White Paper 2000. I like the way, Hugh, that you actually got your name in the title.
Yes, good bit of branding there.
It is. So welcome back to Democracy Sausage. You've been
nice
on
be
here
with
before.
You.
Let's go to this question of China and start broadly. How serious is the situation that Australia finds itself in with China, our largest trading partner and essentially our get-out-of-jail card, really, during the GFC and even now, I guess, given China's voracious appetite for our iron ore and some other things? You know, it's certainly been a key part of our economic resilience in recent global crises, and yet we see the bilateral relationship really, really in a very poor state.
Yeah, well, Mark, I think it is very serious indeed, and it's very serious at two levels. The first is the level you kind of alluded to in your question, and that is that, you know, Australia has for, 25, 30 years, I guess, seen China, I think correctly seen China, as the principal locomotive of our economic growth. And that has depended on there being a workable diplomatic relationship with China. We never believed we had to get on with China on every issue, but there had to be a basic level of acceptance. And although one can have an interesting debate about whose fault it is, there's no doubt that that has disappeared. And that means not just that we've lost a whole lot of economic opportunities so far, you know, particular commodities, wine, barley, so on. But also, and I think more seriously, it casts real doubt on the extent to which we're going to have economic opportunities in China in future.
Mm.
And the key thing economically, from my perspective, is not that we've lost, you know, some billions of dollars a year worth of export markets that we used to have. It's that all of those markets that we thought we might be able to build in the decades ahead and which were so deeply embedded in our judgments about what kind of economic growth we were going to manage over the decades ahead, we must now be very skeptical about our chances of realizing that unless and until something fundamentally changes in the relationship. So that is in itself a very serious thing.
Mm.
But that's not all, because I do also think it's important to recognize that the economic problems, the trade embargoes and so on, the diplomatic imbroglio that we've fallen into over the last, 18 months really, with China, is itself a symptom of something much, much bigger. And that is China's ambitions to become the dominant power in East Asia and our very deep and visceral sense that that's something we cannot accept. And, you know, if we ask fundamentally, why are we in this predicament, with the trade restrictions and so on that the Chinese have put on us, it's not just or primarily that Scott Morrison has been pretty undiplomatic in his dealings with China, though he has. It's that, you know, what underlies that fundamentally is that Australia wants America to remain the dominant power in East Asia, and the Chinese want to take America's place. It's as fundamental as that. Now, we have no model, just as we have no model for our economic future without the economic opportunities that China is the world's biggest economy and fastest growing big economies would appear to offer us. But we have no model of our strategic future in an Asia in which America is not the dominant power, and therefore China's rise and China's ambitions fundamentally threaten things that are really important to us. And I don't think as a country we've really begun to think through how we manage either of those great challenges.
Yes. Now, I want to come back to some of those issues like, US dominance and China's ambition to replace it and where Australia sits. And, you know, there's so many big issues there.
Mm.
But just sticking with the bilateral relationship for a moment, should we be surprised that, I mean, because you mentioned diplomacy, and obviously there's been some pretty cumbersome diplomacy or an absence of it almost, absence of diplomacy in some of the communications going both ways.
Yeah.
But how much should we really be surprised that we get the kinds of punishments that we've seen from Beijing when, in fact, it's really just the external version of how it behaves internally, which is to say it's an autocratic state. It doesn't believe in individual rights. It believes in the primacy of the party, in the primacy of the state itself. It's authoritarian. It's intolerant. It has some virtues, but it has many, many vices according to our values. And it is seeking to behave towards us as it does behave towards, say, internal dissenters.
Citizens, yeah. Look, I think that is a significant part of it. One of the reasons why we, and for that matter a lot of other countries, are anxious about the idea of living in an Asia in which China becomes much more influential, living in a world in which China becomes much more influential, is that when you look at, exactly as you say, if you look at the way the Chinese Communist Party conducts itself to its own citizens, it's impossible not to draw an extrapolation to the way in which it's going to treat us. So I think that is a significant point. But I'd also make two other points. The first is that we don't want to over-romanticize the way in which any great power treats other countries that get in their way. Now, I'm not, I don't want to start sounding like I'm doing a paid political advertisement for the Chinese Communist Party, but the fact is that all great powers are pretty ruthless in trying to get what they want. And, if we were in Iran, for example, we would take the view that the United States was extraordinarily ruthless in trying to get what it wanted. Now, you might say, well, fair enough, because the Iranians have done some pretty terrible things. But still, we just need to recognize that what makes us worry about China as a great power in our region, as potentially the dominant power in our region, is not just that it's communist. It's that it's likely to behave the way any other great power behaves, and it's not our mate. What makes Australia's perspectives on these things a little bit unusual and a little bit sort of optimistic is that for all of our career since all of our national life since European settlement, the strongest power in our world has either been Britain or America, and they've behaved very brutally towards lots of other countries, but they've never behaved brutally towards us because they're our mates. Now, China, whatever else it is, not going to be our mate. So I do think that's a very significant factor. The other point is that the fact that we've got problems with China is not just because Scott Morrison said some impolite things to them. And the Chinese are perfectly capable of being very subtle and quite gentle diplomats when they want to be. I mean, they treated Australia with kid gloves for a long time. If you think back, for example, after Barack Obama came to Canberra and announced the pivot, Julia Gillard and he announced the deployment of US Marines to Darwin, there was a bit of a sense of, well, what are the Chinese going to say about that? But in fact, the Chinese went, okay. So they just, you know, they were very gentle about that. There was no doubt that they were not, they didn't like it, but they decided the best approach then was not to push us too hard and, you know, just to sort of schmooze their way through. And I think the government, the Australian government, also actually treated China quite carefully on that. And so I don't think we should say that the way the Chinese are treating us at the moment diplomatically, again, is just because they're a Communist Party, very authoritarian party. They can be gentle diplomatically if they want to. They've chosen not to be. And so we've got to ask ourselves, what's changed in Beijing's view of us that has made them treat us so differently?
And what do you think that is?
Well, I'm not completely sure, but I do think that as the strategic rivalry between America and China has hotted up, and it's worth remembering that it was only at the very end of 2017, so still only a handful of years ago, that America formally declared China a strategic rival. And under the Trump administration, and then clearly under the Biden administration, that sense of the rivalry between America and China being really stark and strategic and zero sum has grown stronger and stronger. And so I think the Chinese decided that they needed to push back harder against the United States. And I do think we're being made an example of. I think what they're saying to other countries in Asia is when the United States comes knocking and asks you to support them more strongly against us, don't imagine it's not going to cost you anything. And if you want to see what it costs you, look at what we've done to Australia. One of the reasons why I'm pessimistic about our chances of resolving our problems with China is not just that they do, as I said before, in the end go to these very deep questions of strategic order. It's that the Chinese are actually, I think the Chinese are quite happy with what they've achieved. They don't really want us to cave in. I don't think they expect us to cave in. I think they just expect us to suffer and for others to observe our suffering. And in that respect, I'm not sure they've done too badly. I don't see an awful lot of other countries in the East Asian region flocking to follow Australia's example.
No, in fact, there's really not been any particularly structural cost to China for this. I mean, there's been a bit of rhetorical pushback from France recently, I noticed.
Well, yes, but to France is a long way away.
Yeah.
You know, the era when France and Britain, for that matter, had a big say in what happens in the Western Pacific disappeared approximately December the 7th, 1941. And that's not coming back.
No.
No, I mean, if you look at, you know, I think if you want to, you know, Asian political leaders, Asian countries don't talk much about this stuff, talk less about it than we do, and there's a hint there. But if you want to take the temperature of the way our Asian neighbours are seeing this issue, look at what Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister of Singapore, is saying. Look what he said when he stood up next to Morrison when Morrison was stopped off in Singapore on his way to the G7 in Cornwall, or what he said. Lee Hsien Loong had a big article in Foreign Affairs, the Foreign Affairs magazine, in June last year, made a big speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue the June before that. Very consistent message in all of these speeches. What he was saying to the United States is, we don't want a new Cold War in Asia. You are going to have to learn to live with China's power. We don't want China to dominate the region, but we're not going to support you in a new Cold War. You have to learn to live with the Chinese and make space for them. Now, that's a very different message from what Australia's conveying. And I think it's, you know, a reflection, very pragmatic reflection, as you'd expect from Singapore, of a country that has welcomed America's presence but doesn't believe that standing up to China the way we're trying to stand up to China is going to work, and does believe it's going to cost them a lot. And what the Chinese have done to us over the last 12 months or more has reinforced that sense. And to that extent, I think the Chinese, contrary to what a lot of people here are saying, that the Chinese must feel rueful that their strategy hasn't worked because we haven't changed our mind. I don't think that's what they're after. I think for them the strategy has worked. What's the phrase? Kill the fox to frighten the chickens. No, it might be the other way around. But you know, it's people often think that the Chinese must be losing ground politically, diplomatically, because they make people frightened. Oh no. No, that's what they want. They've read Machiavelli. They'd rather be feared than loved.
Yeah, and they think it's more likely, more achievable.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know.
And what can we take from Japan? And I guess New Zealand comes into this as well because, you know, these are close allies of Australia and, of course, Japan being part of the Quad, which, you know, we can come to as well, which is a key irritant now. But both of these countries have, I guess you might call structurally similar positions to ours. Similar, not identical, but quite different. Rhetorical framing of it.
No, look, that's quite right. They're both very interesting cases. I mean, New Zealand's so interesting because so many ways they're so like us.
Yeah.
And Australians very readily just assume that, you know, we're really just identical. In fact, Australia and New Zealand have, considering how similar we are in so many dimensions of our national life, has a history of surprisingly different strategic perspectives from ours. For example, you know, the whole nuclear-powered warships visit story back in the 1980s, which was, you know, pretty seismic in its time, and showed that New Zealanders just took a different perspective. Look, I think in New Zealand's case, that they are less wedded to the idea that American power is the only possible basis for stable order. And they're, I think, more conscious than we are that their economic future depends on China because they're less inclined to take it for granted. One of the reasons is, you know, Australia has, since, you know, both Australia and New Zealand threatened to fall into a big hole when England, Britain entered the European Union common market as it then was back in the 1960s, early 70s. And Australia bounced out of that hole because we had all this iron ore to sell, and New Zealand didn't. So New Zealand's economic story has been much tougher than ours for the last few decades. And we continue to think that whatever else happens, we'll just keep on selling mountains of iron ore to the Chinese and how much can go wrong. And you can see the way in which a lot of Australian commentary about the difficulties with China in the last 12 months or so have been framed around the idea that, you know, whatever happens, the Chinese have to buy our iron ore. So, and when iron ore is $200 a ton, there's a limit to how much damage they can do to us. The New Zealanders are not nearly that complacent. And I think they're much more conscious about the point we were discussing before about the future economic opportunities in China to their economic trajectory. So on the one hand, they're less economically complacent. On the other hand, they're less strategically committed to the idea of the United States as the only possible guarantor. So they're, you know, I think they are taking a more open-minded approach. Japan is fascinating because, of course, Japan really does feel threatened by China. And we all know both the geographical and the historical framing for that. But at the same time, and of course, Japan is a very close ally of the United States, has ever since 1945 absolutely depended on the United States for their security. And so the anxieties we feel about China and the sense of dependence we have on the United States is in some ways in Japan amplified 50 times. But on the other hand, Japan's relationship with the United States has got a much more complex and ambivalent historical foundation. I mean, we just love America because they've always been there for us sort of stuff. At least that's the story we tell ourselves. It's not quite that simple. But no one in Japan thinking about the US alliance forgets the firebombing of Tokyo or Hiroshima and Nagasaki or the occupation. And nor do they forget Japan's own time as a great power in Asia. And they're very conscious of the fact that in the long run, they have to get on with China, and China's always been there, and America's only been there for 100 years. And so the need to fight in Japan to both nurture and protect the US alliance as much as possible because they're so scared of China, but also to find a way to manage relations with China.
Ultimately, their security in a way, I mean, the geography isn't going to change. They've got they've got China very close to them physically, and that's going to be the case forever. Alliances come and go.
That's right.
You know, big, great powers can wane and so forth. And we see, you know, arguably see that in process right at the moment. And so their longer term security has to be with China as well as against it, in a sense.
That is exactly right. In the long run, they have no alternative but to find a way to get on with China. Because in the long run, they can't depend on the United States the way they have in the past. And there's a really, you know, often geopolitics seems very complex, but sometimes what the heart of it, something very simple. Mm. And there's something very simple at the heart of Japan's geostrategic dilemma. The stronger China becomes, the more threatening it is to Japan, and the more costly it is for the United States to protect Japan from China. And therefore, as China becomes stronger, Japan is both more threatened and less able to depend on the United States. So it's more important for it to be able to stand up for itself and more important for it to be able to manage relations with China. And you can see that happening right now because on the one hand, as you say, Japan's a member of the Quad. Prime Minister Suga was the first foreign leader to turn up at the White House under the Biden administration, all of that. On the other hand, in Tokyo right now, they're working like mad to plan and execute a formal state visit to Tokyo by Xi Jinping.
Mm.
Now, if you want an index of how different Japan's approach to China is from Australia's, notwithstanding the fact that we're both very worried about China and we're both strong allies of the United States, the Japanese really want to keep the relationship with China workable.
And it'd also be true to say, would it not, that the more febrile and competitive the relationship is between the two great powers, between China and the United States, the more difficult it is for Japan.
Yes.
Because it can't physically step away from from being the sort of meat in the sandwich there.
That is exactly right. You know, the sort of simple-minded model that I think a lot of people in Washington and Canberra have is that the more scary China becomes, the more scared Japan comes, and the closer it clings to the United States, and so the stronger the United States becomes. But in fact, that's not what's happening. The more scary China becomes, the more the Japanese think, whoa, we can't afford to alienate these guys. So they are trying to walk both sides of the street, in a sense, as we were for a long time, that is, cling to the United States without offending China. Now, during the last 18 months or so, Australia's sort of thrown that model overboard and has sided completely with the United States.
Yeah, because we used to talk, and I've heard you speak on this before, this idea about when and whether we have to choose.
That's right.
And it feels like we've chosen.
Yes, that's right. For a long time, really right back to John Howard's day, you know, the great Australian mantra was, we don't have to choose between America and China. We don't have to choose between our history and our geography. And, you know, that's always a very attractive idea because you don't want to make choices you don't have to make. But that was – and, you know, Scott Morrison was still saying we don't have to choose as late as 2019.
Right.
And, you know, and every Australian prime minister and, for that matter, every Australian leader of the opposition, going all the way back to Julia Gillard in 2010, I think it was, have used that exact form of words. We don't have to choose between America and China. And, you know, you ask yourself, well, I mean, obviously we don't want to choose between America and China, but, you know, there's more to policy than expressing vain hopes.
Yeah.
And when Australian political leaders kept on saying we don't have to choose, what they were really saying was, you know, we somehow think this whole problem's going to go away. We somehow think that China can rise the way it has and America can continue to remain the dominant power in Asia, and the two won't compete. Well, that always just seemed to me to be a complete fantasy.
Mm.
And, you know, it was always the case that we were going to be compelled not necessarily to make the binary choice, but either you side with America and abandon China or vice versa, but have to make a whole lot of complex choices about how you position yourself in between them. Now, exactly as you say, what happened sometime in March or April last year was that Scott Morrison decided that he was just going to choose, and boom, and here we are. And as I say, I think that's in a sense why the Chinese have turned the knob on us so hard after having dealt with us so gently for so long. It was the sense that Australia had stopped trying to balance the US and China, but it simply said we're going to back the United States. And
even that trying. Difficult though it may have been and lacking in credibility though it sometimes may have appeared, was a recognition of the fact that we had a very strong relationship with China and sort of multiple levels, and you've got to respect that.
And huge interest. That's exactly right. I don't want to sound like I'm justifying Chinese policy. I think they're behaved like complete bastards. But that's exactly what they told us. You know, they said, if you think you can treat us like us, like that, and still get all the benefits you want from our rise, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the contrast. If you go all the way back in 2003, John Howard hosted on consecutive days formal state visits by Hu Jintao, then President of China, and George W. Bush. They both, on consecutive days, addressed joint sittings of the Houses of Parliament.
Mm, I was there.
And it was the most you must remember, it was the most remarkable piece of theatre. And the weird thing was, it was George Bush who copped the demonstration outside rather than Hu Jintao by people who were saying, you know, you've got to support democracy. Well, George Bush had his shortcomings as a president. I think we would all agree on that. But what Howard did then was to very dramatically and quite artfully demonstrate that, you know, this was the year of Iraq. No one was a stronger ally of the United States than John Howard. But he was demonstrating to everyone, including to the Chinese, how important we see this relationship. And he in his speech welcoming Hu Jintao, he said something like, you know, we know there are issues upon which you and we are going to differ, and we know there are issues upon which you and the United States will differ, and it will be Australia's role always to represent to both you and the United States how important it is that you put those differences to one side and get along. Let's focus on the things that unite us, not the things that divide us, very John Howard line.
Mm.
Now, that was the perfect articulation of the kind of position that a country like Japan now adopts. It's a perfect articulation of the position that Australia abandoned for some reason a couple of 18 months ago. And, you know, the question we've got to ask ourselves is, well, where do we think that's going to end? You know, what's the end point of what's the strategy and what's the strategy aimed to achieve?
It's such a good question because China's not going to go away. And I know that sounds like a really prosaic statement, but it's so fundamental to all this.
But actually, Mark, you know, you can sort of turn that argument on its head and say, what must these guys think if they think what they're doing now, I mean the Australian government, if they think that alienating China the way they're doing it is a good strategy? Well, they must think that China is going to go away. In other words, they must think that China is going to be persuaded to back off its challenge to US power and somehow accept America as the dominant power in Asia, accept America as the dominant power globally, even as China's economy grows to overtake the Americans and indeed, according to government's own estimates, to a significant degree surpass it. And you might say, well, how could they possibly expect that? Well, the point is, that's what they think in Washington.
Right.
That, you know, the rationale for America's policy, as I see it, is that they somehow think that if they just push hard enough, the Chinese will decide that this is all a big mistake and they're going to give it away. Well, they've met very different Chinese from the ones I've met, if that's what they think.
And the ones we're all seeing. Let's take a quick break there and come back and continue this in a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we were talking about the critical issue at the heart of all of this, the rise of China and the competition between the US and China. Malcolm Turnbull and many others have referred to the Thucydides trap, the notion that conflict is inevitable, really, as one power rises to take on another and perhaps to replace it as the dominant power. Is that still the inevitable in your view? Is there a way that this can be worked out?
No, look, it's a really important question. I mean, just to defend poor old Thucydides, I think the scholars would argue that he didn't really use the word he used in Greek when he said it was the rise of Athens' power and the fear this generated in Sparta made war inevitable. It didn't actually mean inevitable. It meant something like very bloody likely. And that's a significant difference.
Yeah.
Inevitable is a very big word in human affairs.
Yeah.
I don't think a war between the US and China is inevitable.
Is that a way of saying you don't think that war with like an invasion of Taiwan is inevitable? And the US might not step in?
Well, put it this way, the war can always be avoided by one side or the other giving up.
Right.
And that's actually, if you look back through history at the other examples that people cite of the Thucydides trap at work, rising power meets an established power, the time when they didn't go to war was the time when the established power said to the rising power, oh, okay, I'll step back and give you some space. And that's a clear possibility.
I mean, so that's a kind of a sphere of influence argument, isn't it, really? Or at least it fits into that frame where the world would make a pragmatic decision, the US would make a pragmatic decision that although it doesn't like it, although it's been a long-term friend and supporter of Taiwan, as Australia has, although perhaps less sort of officially, if it did happen that a strategic, pragmatic decision is taken to accept it, that is, as going back to your original point, that is what great powers do. They establish spheres of influence. Yeah. They secure their peripheries.
Yeah.
And they need living space, if I can use that.
Yeah, rather. Use that phrase.
Yes.
Now, look, that is exactly right. And, you know, just to make the point a little bit more harshly, that's exactly what America's done in the Western Hemisphere since 1824 under the Monroe Doctrine. You know, hands off. This is our part of the world. Mm. No other power from outside the Western Hemisphere will have any kind of strategic role in this part of the world. We are in charge. And if you're Mexico or Canada, let alone Cuba or Venezuela, you might think that that's a pretty rough kind of idea, but it's worked in the end, and it certainly worked for America. And one option—
Justified Hawaii even.
Well, exactly, yes. Mm. And one option for the United States and the way in which war could be avoided is the United States says, okay, well, we've been the dominant power in the Western Pacific for a long time. It's worked well for us. It's worked well for the Western Pacific, but things have changed now. We're going to step back. And it could either be step back completely and leave the East Asia and the Western Pacific to China, or step back partially and say, okay, we'll have some sort of power-sharing arrangement. We're going to be less influential. You're going to be more influential, but we'll still be here to play some kind of role. Now, I've long argued that that second option would be the best outcome for Australia. I mean, the best outcome would be American primacy continuing, but if you don't think that's possible, and I don't think it is, in view of China's power and ambition, then America only stepping halfway back would be much better. It would be very hard to do. You'd have to negotiate some kind of power-sharing arrangement.
It would involve really changing the architecture, the sort of the multilateral architecture around the world, wouldn't it?
Completely.
Things like the World Trade Organization, the way that Security Council works, these sorts of things.
Well, yes, although I think that would, but I'd also make a distinction between the way East Asia works and the way the global order works.
Right.
Because I think, you know, I think at the global order, you know, people sometimes worry about China's going to rule the world. That's not going to happen. No country's ever ruled the world, actually. And China's going to be very strong. It's going to be the strongest power in the world for most of this century. But it's not going to be the only strong power in the world. There's always going to be lots of other powers, including, of course, the United States, which is not going anywhere, and India and Europe and Russia and so on. So I think we're going to see a global order and those global institutions that underpin it, like the UN and WTO and so forth, in which China plays a significantly bigger role. But in East Asia, in its own backyard, I think China's not going to want to play a significantly bigger role. It's not going to play the role like America does in the Western Hemisphere. So if the US can negotiate with China to persuade China to accept a continuing US role in East Asia and the Western Pacific, that would be a very hard thing to do. Better for us.
Kind of vital for us, really.
Well, nice if we can have it is what I'd say, because in the end, we may end up having no choice but to accept China as the dominant power in East Asia and the Western Pacific. Now, that's a very gloomy thing to say, but if you just look at it, you know, historically, objectively, so to speak, like a Martian would look at it coming to Earth from, you know, without any of the background and say, well, here's China, world's biggest economy, a very strong military, a very strong economic and diplomatic weight. Why wouldn't you expect to be the dominant power in its own backyard, the way America's the dominant power in its own backyard?
Well, that's a really good question, because there was much positive talk about the Asian century not so long ago. And it always struck me as kind of odd not to accept the proposition that seemed to be, you know, embedded within that, of course, there would be an Asian hegemon.
Yes. Well, that's right. And a lot of the talk about the Asian century both in Australia and in the US and elsewhere, was predicated on the idea that the Asian century would and could only happen if America remained the dominant power.
I know, the American century gives way to the Asian century, yeah. but with the Americans still in charge.
Yeah. And that's because people, you know, I mean, I had a lot of conversations with Americans about this, you know, right through the last, well, 2 decades. And the very strong conviction that the Asian century had to be an American century too, because only America could keep Asia peaceful and stable. And I wrote a book 10 years ago called The China Choice, which was about this idea of the US and China sharing power. And I, as one does when one writes a book like that, I spent a lot of time wandering around the United States giving seminars to anyone who'd listen, trying to, you know, flog the book and sell the idea. And what I kept on finding, and this was only in 2010, 2011, so China's growth rise was already a very big deal then. Americans, even very sophisticated Americans who knew China very well, simply couldn't get their head around the idea that China might seriously challenge American leadership in Asia. And they had a whole, you know, it's not going to be strong enough economically, it won't be strong enough militarily, it won't be strong enough diplomatically, it won't really want to because it benefits from America's presence. And if it does challenge in the end, we'll just beat it and they'll back off. And I found it, you know, quite hard. I mean, actually impossible to sell people on the idea that America seriously had to start thinking of compromising with China.
Was this an arrogance that was based on sort of old thinking about command economies and the sort of dead end that they're in? I mean, because the other thing you'd often hear was that the military, the strategic power of China was so much less significant than that of the US. You know, the military might of the US is vast.
Look, that's right. There were several components to it. One was a conviction that China's economy couldn't keep growing.
Yeah.
And, you know, at any one time, and the same is true today, you can open a newspaper anywhere in the world and there'll be an article saying the Chinese economy is about to hit absolutely fundamental problems which are going to make the whole thing grind to a halt. And, of course, it's always possible. You know, they've done a totally remarkable thing for the last 30, 40 years, you know, for decades, 10% per annum real growth year after year. There was always a chance the whole thing had come crashing down. My point to them was, yes, that's possible, but don't bet on it. You know, I mean, I might win Tats Lotto, but I'm not going to sacrifice my superannuation and rely on that as my salvation.
Yeah, it's a dubious,
and the fact is that the argument is against it. The evidence is against it, because the fact is the Chinese Communist Party have always faced significant barriers to keeping China's economy growing. And they've always overcome them.
And they've always been, within all the doctrine and all the hardline, there's a huge pragmatism there.
That's exactly right, Mark. Pragmatism and a real capacity to formulate and implement policy. And, you know, in Australia today, where we don't take that for granted anymore, seeing a country that can identify a problem, analyze how to deal with it, get a solution, and implement that solution across a country of 1.4 billion people, it's a formidably effective system. So people assume that. People assume that the politics was very fragile. You know, a very dear friend of mine, David Shambaugh, wrote an essay a couple of years ago, which he called The Coming Collapse of China. Now, this is a bloke who really knows China well and very lovely guy, very sophisticated. I regard him as a dear friend and a very respected colleague. But I did write to him and say, mate, I mean, maybe, but really, where's the evidence that this is going to happen now? And so, you know, across the US system and the Australian system, a very strong conviction that somehow this problem was going to go away because the Chinese would solve our problem for us by screwing it up. And all I can say is we can't rely on that. And in fact, you know, the only prudent basis for Australian and, for that matter, American policy is to adopt as a working hypothesis that the Chinese are going to make this work. And that means their economy will end up. Well, the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Foreign Affairs White Paper of 2017 had the estimate that by 2030, China's economy would be $42 trillion and America's economy would be 24. 42 to 24. Mm. Now, you know, that's not just China edging ahead of the United States.
That's surging past.
That's surging past, leaving it in the dust. And, well, that's an exaggeration. America is still going to be a very strong country with huge assets and a lot of power. It's just not going to be powerful enough to confront China in China's backyard. China's not going to become powerful enough to confront America in the Western Hemisphere. But, you know, they're going to be kind of equal powers. There's a, you know, Henry Kissinger, a complex figure, but quite a good analyst, foreshadowed precisely this situation in a book he wrote 30 years ago called Diplomacy, in which he said the thing about the United States and China is not that they're so different, but that they're so alike.
Yes, I recall this now. Yeah.
You know, I just do think that the US, China's desire to achieve in its own region what America's achieved in the Western Hemisphere, and its capacity to, as America's capacity to marshal the vast resources of a continental-sized country with a huge population, with immense reservoirs of human talent, you know, they are kind of similar. They're more similar than the United States and the Soviet Union were.
And yet the thesis is also that, you know, as you were saying at the start, superpowers or major powers have certain common characteristics.
That's right.
They'll always behave in very self-interested ways.
Yeah.
And Paul Keating, for example, has been quite critical of NATO, what he called nibbling at the pie crust by sort of eking away these peripheral states of the old Soviet Union because of what, you know, the message that sends and the attitude it sets up in Moscow, for example.
No, that is exactly right. And, in fact, you know, although the cases are very different in some way, there are important analogies between what's happening between the US and China in East Asia and Russia and the United States in Europe. You know, at the end of the Cold War, there was this sort of phenomenal burst of optimism that somehow America had emerged as a unique power. People called it the New Rome, you know, end of history idea, that America was simply going to be unchallengeably powerful.
That liberal democracy had arrived,
and that the whole world was going to accept America as a global primary power. America was going to rule the world, and that all the other powers in the world, including China and Russia, would just say, "Fine, we'll live under that framework." And you know, it was a very attractive idea. It would have been great if it had proved to be true, but it just proved not to be right, and it proved not to be right in all kinds of ways. It didn't work out in the Middle East. We know that, but it didn't work out in Asia because in the end, China did want to establish its own sphere of influence, and it didn't work out in Eastern Europe because in the long run, Russia was never going to accept the way in which its eastern borders, its western borders, were redrawn at the end of the Cold War, and for that to have been not that was bad enough by itself, but when NATO started moving into what had been not just Russian sphere of influence but Russian territory, and the whole story about the Baltic states, for example, I'm not saying that there wasn't a great deal of evil in the way in which Russia and the Soviet Union absorbed the Baltic states,
and indeed hunger within those populations yearning for freedom,
absolutely, and I have a great deal of sympathy for that. But the fact, you know, this is power politics; it's a pretty brutal business, and so our capacity, you know, what our objective, the West's objective at the end of the Cold War should have been to reframe the international order in Europe in such a way that Russia would be content with it and that Russia would emerge as a stable, prosperous, effective country that was a happy member of that order.
And would see some dividends.
Exactly,
from that,
exactly. And we're going to feel, as all countries want to feel, secure and prosperous and respected. And, you know, to push NATO into Eastern Europe was frankly destroying the chances of building an order in Europe that Russia could accept. And now we live with the consequences.
Yeah.
And likewise, as China's power grew, it was always, it seemed to me, going to be necessary to reframe the Asian order in ways that give China a status that it's willing to accept. Now, people resist that, and I'm certain extent I resist it, or at least I regret it, because there's so many things about China that are so unattractive, frankly frightening. But the fact is, the alternative is, this gets back to Thucydides, in the end, if you don't make those compromises, you end up being driven to war. Mm. And we should not underestimate the probability that that's what's happening at the moment.
Well, I want to come to that war in the possibility of it in the few moments we have left. But before we go to that, you mentioned the word respect before.
Yep.
And I'm interested in I suppose, Frances Adamson's comments at the press club, the outgoing head of DFAT. Mm. She made a very interesting observation about China where she said that it had a combination of great power and considerable insecurity, and that this is a very dangerous combination. It struck me as a clever observation.
Mm.
Just your thoughts on it.
Yes. Look, I think there's something in it. I wouldn't have actually used the word insecurity. I'd have used the word dissatisfaction. I mean, China does feel, I'm sure, that the present order in Asia doesn't work for it, in East Asia, doesn't work for it, at least doesn't work for it now.
But it seems to yearn for that kind of respect, you know, for that. And that's what I think she meant by insecurity, yeah, this sort of sense that it's like a huge teenager.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to be a little bit cautious about that because I don't think China certainly does want respect. But I don't think it's so very different in that way from every other country, including Australia. You know, every country and citizens in every country, and not just democracies, want their country to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very sensitive to that. Australians are very sensitive to that. You know, when Scott Morrison stands up and says, you know, Australia absolutely must stand up to China because our sovereignty is at stake. Now, what they're saying is, you know, you can't treat us like that. Well, I think the Chinese have a very strong version of that, and it's worth remembering or just trying to reflect on the personal experience of individual Chinese. You know, if you're Chinese, you come at the question of China's status in the world today with four very big elements. One is, of course, a very intense sense of China's millennial history as a great power, stretching back, you know, 4,000 years. And it's true in some ways. I mean, it's a complicated story, but there's a lot in that. The second is a very strong sense of China's humiliation at the hands of the West between the Opium Wars and 1949. And we in the West might think that they overplay that a bit. Maybe they do. But actually, the basic structure of the story is pretty right. You know, a great Chinese state was taken apart partly by what happened inside China, but to a significant degree because of the intrusion of the West into China and the weakening of that caused. Then the third thing is, of course, phenomenal sense of what China's achieved, but not so much since 1949, but since 1979. And, you know, Chinese of our generation have themselves lived through the transformation of China from an incredibly poor country to the country we see today. And one just has to acknowledge how proud they must feel of that. And then, of course, there's a sense of China's future. I don't think there's a lot of complacency in China, but there's a lot of confidence that they know how to make this work. And so with that sort of framing, do they want to be respected? You bet. I think we risk belittling that by calling it insecurity.
Mm, okay.
And I think, you know, we don't want to see, you know, we don't want to glamorize the Chinese.
I hope I've quoted her correctly then.
She did. But I think it's a widely held view. There is a sort of a genuine point to it. That is, China feels that its prospects for future economic growth and its prospects for the kind of security he wants do depend on it being able to establish that sphere of influence. I mean, it's the point you made before. That's what great powers do. They want to, you know, the Russian phrase is the near abroad.
Mm.
You know, they want to dominate the region around them. And actually, so do we. I mean, you know, we claim, in effect, a sphere of influence in the Southwest Pacific.
Yeah.
That's what the Pacific step up of
precisely, and we get pretty edgy when we see Chinese money or whatever.
But whenever anybody else comes in, yeah. I mean, when the Libyans started to penetrate in the 1980s or the Russians in the 1980s or the Japanese, of course, in the 1930s and 40s or the French in the 1870s or the Germans in the 1890s, you know, we've always been edgy about any potentially hostile major power intruding into the Southwest Pacific because we believe that's our backyard. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised, and I don't think we should be dismissive, that China feels somewhat the same way, just as America feels its security and prosperity depends on dominating the Western Hemisphere. Now, again, saying it's understandable doesn't mean I like it.
No.
It doesn't even mean I think it's necessarily justifiable. But but it's real, and it's something we need to learn to deal with. And so I think, although I think there is an element of insecurity and therefore an element of justification in Francis Adamson's formulation, I don't think that's the best way to think of that phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, it's been terrific talking to you. I've got one last thing, as I foreshadowed, to raise with you, and that is the sort of prickly question of a conflict were it to occur.
Yeah.
Because you've written about that as well recently, and you've said that it could have extraordinary dimensions, really. Mm. Can you just speak to that?
Yeah, look, it's a difficult issue in some ways because it's hard to talk about it, I think.
Seeing really alarmist.
Rigorously, yeah. Without sounding a bit sort of Wagnerian and alarmist about it. But I do think, you know, and Thucydides is right to this extent, that the contest between America and China in Asia today is a contest between the world's two most powerful states over which of them will dominate the most dynamic and important region in the world. So the stakes don't get any bigger than this. And this is exactly the kind of issue the great powers do go to war over. And so I think the chances of a US-China war over the next few years are really quite high. And one of the things that makes it high is that unlike during the Cold War, but like, for example, the lead-up to the First World War, there's a real danger that both sides underestimate the resolve of the other. See, the reason why the Cold War never turned into a hot war is that in the end, both America and Russia respected one another's spheres of influence. Okay,
yeah.
Stalin had Eastern Europe, Washington had Western Europe, and there was a big line down the middle.
And that's why the Cuban Missile Crisis was the crisis that it was, because breached that.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, because that was one of the few times where Khrushchev, in that case, miscalculated. But what they both learned from that is, whoa, we're not going to do that again. Yeah. You know, there's a big red line.
Yeah.
And neither side of it is going to cross it. And neither side was going to cross it because both sides knew that the other side would fight a nuclear war if they did. The risk in Asia today is that the Chinese think they can push America out of Asia without a war because they think in the end the Americans will back off. And the Americans think they can deter the Chinese from doing that. Because they think the Chinese will back off.
Because they think the Chinese will calculate that if America enters, it becomes too costly.
It becomes too costly. So, you know, neither side wants to fight the other, but both sides hope they can achieve their objective without fighting the other because the other side will back off rather than fight. And that is exactly what happened in 1914. You know, when people look at the analogy with 1914, they often say, well, that's one of those Thucydides examples of a rising power meeting an established power. And it was that. But much more importantly, what happened in 1914 is that everyone underestimated everybody else's resolve. The Austrians thought they could attack Serbia after the assassination of the Archduke without being attacked by the Russians because they thought the Russians would back off. And the Russians thought they could attack Austria without being attacked by Germany because they thought the Germans would back off. And the Germans thought they could attack Russia without being attacked by France because they thought the French would back off. And none of them backed off.
Yeah.
And the danger we have is exactly the same way as a crisis emerges, and it easily could, the Americans will think, we must defend Taiwan, for example. And if we make it plain that we're going to defend Taiwan, the Chinese will back off.
The American policy at the moment is strategic ambiguity on that question.
It is, and that's dangerous.
Yeah.
Because that
– Well, it feeds that uncertainty.
Because it feeds the uncertainty. It encourages the Chinese to think that if they attack Taiwan, the Americans will
pitch a moan. It encourages the Chinese to think they call it strategic ambiguity because they want an out.
Yeah.
And therefore read that as code for, well, when push comes to shove, they'll step backwards.
Well, the original idea of strategic ambiguity was that the ambiguity would be resolved in different ways on different sides of the strait. That the Taiwanese would believe the Americans probably wouldn't support them, so they wouldn't do anything stupid. And the Chinese would think the Americans probably would support them, so they wouldn't do anything stupid. The risk is that's now precisely reversed, and the Chinese assume that America won't defend Taiwan. And I think there's a real risk of that. And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, back when the present policy was first formulated by the United States, America was sure to win a maritime war in the Western Pacific against China. The Chinese Navy and Air Force weren't worth anything. and America's, you know, position was absolutely dominant. But in the last 25 years, in fact, since the Taiwan Straits crisis of 1996, the Chinese have done a very clever job of investing in exactly the right capabilities to win a war, or at least to stop America winning a war over Taiwan. And so the cost and risk to the United States of winning a war over Taiwan have gone up, and therefore the chances that they can persuade the Chinese they're willing to fight that war have gone down. Now, that's not to say the Americans won't fight it, but it means they won't win it. And it also means that the war is more likely to break out because of the chances of miscalculation on both sides. And that's, you know, it's hard to exaggerate the seriousness of that, because we're not talking here about, you know, another bad day in the office like Iraq or Afghanistan. This would be, well, first thing is, it would be the first war between great powers since the Second World War. It would be, well, there was some skirmishes between the Chinese and the Russians and the Soviets in the late 60s, but it will be the first war between nuclear-armed states, except for a little skirmish between the Indians and the Pakistanis. It will be the first maritime war, large-scale maritime war, except for the Falklands crisis, since 1945. And neither side's going to win. So I think the chances of it turning into a full-scale regional war are very high, and the chance of escalating to a nuclear war are high. And the chance of it breaking out overall is not low. I mean, if it happens, if there's a war between America and China sometime, you know, this year or next year, no historian will look back and say that came out of a clear blue sky. They'll go back and look at what's happened.
And look at everything that Xi Jinping keeps saying about it being part of the overall
plan. And look at everything that the Americans keep saying and saying, oh, well, that was going to happen.
There was a fair bit of signaling
they'll,
there.
They'll say it was inevitable. It wasn't inevitable.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was very risky. And I've often said that one of the big differences between my whole perspective on this issue and most other people's is that I rate the risk of a US-China conflict higher than most other people. I rate the chances of that conflict escalating to a truly catastrophic war higher than most people. And I therefore think it's more urgent to do whatever we can, including making significant sacrifices, which is what we'd have to do in order to avoid that. Because when we sit here in Canberra, or in Australia, or for that matter in Washington, D.C., and say we'd like America to remain the dominant power in Asia, yeah, of course we could. But what are we prepared to pay for that? And the thing we've got to remember is that if we start a war over that, we won't win it. We can't preserve US primacy in Asia by starting a war with China, because apart from anything else, what does winning a war with China mean?
Yeah,
you know, we know what winning a war with Japan or with Germany meant. It meant that you know, we or our allies occupied the capitals of those countries, destroyed their system of government, replaced it with one we like better.
Achieved total surrender. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, whatever else happened, the Royal Australian Regiment is never going to march across Tiananmen Square, and neither is the 101st Airborne.
Yeah.
Any more than the PLA is going to march down the main street of Washington, down the mall in Washington, D.C. I hope they don't march down Anzac Parade. Mm. If we think there's a military solution to this, if we think we can either deter China from challenging the United States or fight a successful war to defeat that challenge, we're kidding ourselves, particularly if it's a nuclear war. Now, an earlier generation of strategists, the men and women who sat down after the Second World War and asked themselves, what does the advent of nuclear weapons mean, understood that this changed everything. And one of the things that worries me is that in the decades since the end of the Cold War, we've forgotten about how important nuclear weapons are in these calculations.
Yeah.
And we've started again to think that we can just push one another around the way
it's
they tried
like
to do in 1914.
It's almost like there's an assumption that they're so horrific that they won't be used.
That's right.
You know, they've stopped being as dangerous as they used to be because we're smarter now or something.
That's exactly right. And what they forget is that although the tensions of the Cold War disappeared, the weapons didn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's still right now as we speak, there's submarines at sea with missiles, with multiple warheads.
Yeah.
The Chinese have now got submarines at sea. There are intercontinental ballistic missiles in their silos ready to go. You know, it's as dangerous as it was during the Cold War and with much less caution. I mean, people talk at length about the idea of a US-China war without ever mentioning that they're both nuclear armed states.
Yeah.
And, you know, for someone of my generation, you know, my first decade in this business was the last decade of the Cold War where we thought about nuclear weapons all the time. And I keep on wanting to sort of jump up and shake people and say, remember what nuclear war means.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very good point. It's a very sobering warning to end on. Hugh White, it's been, I can't think of a more interesting and rewarding conversation to have. So I really enjoyed it. I'm sure people listening will have the same view, even if we've ended on that very, stirring sort of note.
Well, look, thanks very much, Mark. I really enjoyed the opportunity. And, you don't get me into the studio if you want to end on a jolly note.
What was your most recent book? Because you've written many.
Oh, my most recent book is called How to Defend Australia, and it argues that in the light of all the things we've been talking about, Australia better work out how to survive in an Asia in which the United States isn't the dominant power and China is, and India as well, of course, in its own way, and we therefore better work out how we can defend Australia independently from a major Asian power. I think we can do it, but it costs a lot of money.
Yeah, and we have to think more deeply about it than perhaps we are.
Absolutely.
Hugh White, thanks so much for being on Democracy Sausage again. That's all we have time for today. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.